So next up, we have E-Trade. With me on stage is the Chief Financial Officer, Mike Peavy. Welcome, Mike, and thanks for taking the time to come from cold New York to sunny Florida.
Thanks, Christian.
Thank you. So I guess, look, I don't think it's a better place to start than obviously the big announcement from Schwab around pricing cuts. Maybe just talk about how you think that impacts the competitive landscape for retail trading, and then more importantly, or how do you think about responding to that?
Sure. Last week's announcement brought into the public light something that's been going on, or dynamics in the industry that have been going on for really quite some time, and that's really that we are in an intensely competitive environment. Commission rates are one lever firms in our industry can apply to manage the competitive environment. Now, the thing that's important when you think about commission rates is that we've been in this environment for a while. We've seen new entrants at very low commission rates. We've seen a new entrant at zero commission rates. We've also seen at-scale players with published commission schedules that are below the rate that was announced last week. Through all of this, firms flourish. They continue to grow. They continue to do well, continue to prosper. Well, why is that? Well, it's really because in today's industry, consumers are the most value conscious, really, that they've ever been in terms of even looking at what they get from the product that they're using. It's about the customer experience. It's about the quality of service. It's about the platform, the execution quality, the content, the education, and all of those items that you deliver as a value proposition to your customer. That's why we think that if you look at sort of the history of commission moves and you look back to the last ones that occurred in 2010, they really didn't change meaningfully growth rates or share within the marketplace. Now, in terms of our response, I think our response really, you know, is to remain steadfast in our approach to our growth goals. We laid out back in September a very aggressive set of goals, and we feel we are making very good progress on the way to those goals. When we laid them out, we were in a competitive environment. We don't think last week's announcement fundamentally changes that in any way, and so we are going to continue to make progress towards those goals. I think that the only thing I would add is that some of the underlying backdrop of what's drives the interest rate dynamics in the industry, keep in mind that we benefit materially as well, and so we do have the capacity to respond if need be, and a response may not necessarily be through a commission rate.
What else? Which other way could you respond?
It could be through a better product and service offering. It could be through offering more what would be charged for type services today. It could be competitive in other areas of the revenue line that we can drive our response through.
Just curious on those growth goals, does this in any way, though, change, if not the goals, but the timeline of achieving them? And I ask because I completely hear you in terms of if you look back to 2010, there weren't material share shifts from changing in pricing, but one could also argue that the incremental or the new person coming into the industry, a price is at least something they consider. Just curious if you know the change in at least headline pricing dynamic changes that timeline to achievability.
Yeah, look, in short, our growth goals have a very aggressive timeline. We think our growth goals are achievable, but we do think there are also aggressive levels, but not ludicrous levels. We do think that we feel very good about the pathing we're on to achieve them and the necessary time frame to build out the items that we're doing. Really what we're looking at is really fundamentally upgrading aspects of our platform, reviving our brand, and removing dissatisfiers and pain points. I'm going to touch on some of those as we talk through the conversation, but that's those are the key elements of really what's going to drive growth for us.
Okay. So maybe just to level set the conversation, remind us of what those goals are, and then I guess more importantly, if you do not meet those goals in the timeline, what does that mean for the firm?
Sure. Back in September, we outlined growth goals around accounts, assets, derivative mix, and growth in managed products, specifically about 2 to 300 basis point growth in our overall asset and account rates of growth relative to our history, growing our managed products to about $6 billion and growing our derivative mix to about 35%. And the timeline we put on that was 18 to 24 months. That's to bring everyone to sort of what are the goals? How are we looking to achieve those goals? Number one, the successful integration of Options House. When we talk about the integration of the purchase of Options House, we're not necessarily just talking about taking their customer base and shifting it onto our platform. What we're really talking about is taking the number one options platform in the industry, the number one rated platform, and taking the elements of that platform that have led it to be successful and incorporating all of those elements into the E-Trade platform. That should give us a competitive advantage, really, within the derivative space and the active trader space, which is really core to the heritage of the company. That's really element number one and why the successful integration is so important into hitting our growth goals. Two, we started this focus, you know, a significant amount of energy on removing anything that causes a customer to leave. We want to make sure that when a customer comes to E-Trade, they never have a reason to leave. So we spend a lot of time looking at what we call internally our customer dissatisfiers. But I think more importantly than just the service element, or where a customer could be dissatisfied with the service offering, it's really the evolution of today's digital marketplace. In some sense, we used to talk about, you know, good services meaning how fast someone responds to a phone call. That's really not really what it is anymore. If a customer is calling in, then in some sense, your platform's already failed. They had to have a reason to call in. The expectations of today's digital consumers have never really been higher.
So just maybe on that, the point around derivatives and options, because for the most part, it's probably been the only part of the industry that's actually grown over the last few years. You know, and hate to hop on the whole Schwab announcement again, but it feels like that could be a place for further price competition for them. Does that, you know, change in any way how you think about growing that part of the business? We see another round of price cuts.
Yeah, sure. The short answer to that question is no. Derivative traders, those that engage meaningfully in the options market, are some of the most coveted customers, but they also have the highest expectations. They're coveted simply because of their recurring activity around options expirations. But their demands on a platform I would describe as almost near institutional, you know, in terms of what they're asking for, or what would have been an institutional platform only a few short years ago. Platform matters to them, experience matters to them, service matters to them, and execution quality matters to them. It's really the value proposition of the offering. I really don't see today's active derivative trader moving to a platform that's less good to save a couple bucks.
Right. So maybe how should we think about a topic which was a big topic a couple of quarters ago was around your inorganic growth strategy. So maybe talk a little bit more about how you think you can use that to accelerate growth.
Sure. Let me just start off clearing up a bit of confusion. When we announced our growth goals, our growth goals are really for the organic company. They're for E-Trade plus Options House, fully formed, sort of exiting this year into next year. We're not really pursuing an M&A agenda to drive to the growth goals we've announced. We believe that should drive additional growth or additional scale that we don't have today, and that's why we're pursuing that. Now let me step back. We spend a lot of time talking about M&A. Why is that? Well, for a very long period of time, we weren't a credible acquirer. We, for financial or regulatory reasons, we were not really active in the space. So we thought it was important to really talk about M&A about 18 months ago. We brought it into the dialogue of our quarterly earnings calls, and we gave an update of the things that we would place priority on. With the leadership change that occurred in September, we felt it was time to do that again on this last quarterly earnings call. And we highlighted some of the key areas that we're looking at: brokerage, wealth management, and RIA. Let me touch on a couple of those in turn. On the wealth management side, what we're looking at is we have an active channel in our corporate services business today into the wealth management market at sort of servicing 20% of the S&P 500, 1,000 large corporate clients. I mean, you could do the math of the number of executives, the number of one-level downs that really are customers today on the participant side of our stock plan business. For those that want to have a move that wealth into a self-directed platform and manage their own money, we do a great job with them today. but it's also an area where, you know, the demand for wealth services is very high, and we don't have the product to offer them. So something small and scalable in the wealth space will allow us to further grow out of our corporate services channel, could do quite a lot for us on a very small, non-transformative type acquisition. Now look at the other side of what we talk about in RIA. What we mean to do in RIA is really leverage the scale of our clearing broker-dealer. An RIA channel doesn't necessarily need to be a large-scaled opportunity in and of itself. The fact that you are a clearing broker-dealer, that we have $300 billion in customer assets today with us, that essentially the RIA just adds scale to that operation, to that technology stack that's already there, to the clearing broker-dealer that's already there. So to become an RIA custodian doesn't really require us to do a large, significant, transformative deal. It requires us really to acquire a good platform and a meaningful enough amount of assets to start into the business.
I guess I'm just curious how that would scale, though. Even if you went off and got a small platform on the RIA side, how would you scale given the competitive set that you'd be challenging in that space? Well, fairly large, fairly well scaled.
Sure. I would say two things there. One, the RIA space has been growing at a level faster than both the traditional space as well as the direct space. So something that just allows, you know, sort of trend participation and growth could be a great addition. But more than that, if you look at where the RIA marketplace today on the services that RIAs are demanding, they get those services from a number of different places. There's probably an opportunity to grow by offering a more diverse set of services and a better platform than what they currently have available to them.
Maybe just step back a little bit and just think about, by here, what you're talking about, you know, RIAs, active traders, wealth management. You know, these are things, or these are opportunity sets your competitors have been attacking for 10 to 15 years. Is there a danger here that E-Trade is fighting the battles of the past?
In short, I would say no. Let's start with active trader. I mean, we were once the undisputed leader in the active trading space. What we are doing today is really refreshing our platform and bringing it forward. We feel that we're really not top of mind for today's prospect active trading client, and we need to make our platform top of mind. We need to put it in the top competitive set, make it the best platform out there. That speaks directly to why we acquired Options House, why directly we're doing so much work on building the platform. We believe trading is core to our DNA. It's a big part of our business. We have a lot of customers that have been with us a long time, and we feel that we're just restoring and maintaining the competitive position in that marketplace. In wealth management, it goes back to a little bit of what I was saying before. We have customers with us, both in the corporate services channel, which is what I talked about, but even customers that have been with us who have just been naturally growing more wealth. Maybe they opened up an account, were very low cost, they bought some mutual funds, they've been growing wealth over time. We lose those customers sometimes to a wealth management platform. Having something scalable in wealth management that allows us to maintain customers as they grow and gain assets and look for more advice, and also penetrate that corporate services channel, could be very attractive and very scalable in a way. And in RIA, we have $300 billion of assets today, our customer assets. So I don't think we're talking about a landscape shift in strategy. We just want to participate in an area of the market that has been growing quite well.
Maybe switch over to the financial side here. You recently laid out, long-term operating margin targets of 46%. And when I think about that in the context of some of your peers, and, you know, mix is always different for different businesses, but it is above where bigger scaled or more scaled peers are. And in the context of a very competitive business going forward, you know, how realistic do you think that ultimately is?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start out where we are today. We announced on our earnings call that our target for the year is a 38% operating margin. But within that 38%, we've included a lot of one-time items, one-time integration cost, the one-time cost of breaking 50. We also are in a sort of pre-synergy state on the revenue synergies of the OH deal. So as we move to the back half of the year and those synergies come online, that will naturally expand the operating margin. And then the balance sheet growth as well. As the balance sheet grows, we would expect the operating margin to expand as well. So we're projecting to exit this year in the low 40s. So the gap really is not really between 38 and 46. It's really low 40s to 46. Now, when we layer on our growth initiatives and interest rates, we think sort of the marginal operating margin to apply is going to be in that 70% to 80% range for what we're able to deliver. That means a good amount of it is falling through to the bottom line and how we get to that 46%. Obviously, you could go higher than 46 on the interest rate side if all of that revenue came through, but we don't really think that's going to happen. We're putting something for increased competition and our increased response to it over time. You know, if the competitive environment was to get much more challenging or intensify from here, we've thought about the competitive environment in the way we've set this. If it was to continue to intensify, then, you know, obviously there is some leverage there. We are right. benefiting from the movement in interest rates. But we feel very good about really getting to a mid-40s type operating margin. Now, when we compare to competitors, I apply a little bit of caution. They have very different businesses, and they operate large RIA channels, which are lower margin businesses. So we should get to an operating margin that is well north of theirs.
Maybe just, you know, thinking about the impact of the current rate, you know, political backdrop on your business, and I think about tax reform and all that should be net beneficial to E-Trade. So maybe if you walk through some of the potential things, whether it's again tax reform, or changes in the regulatory landscape around fees and costs, kind of walk us through where you see benefits, and you know if there are any risks also to the business.
Sure. Let's start with the $50 billion. Threshold. You know, we announced last year that we're going to go through the $50 billion threshold, and sitting here today, we're roughly 52 when we announced on our earnings call. It's about where we are today. So, you know, looking at that, it was just simple math, right? Do we have enough balance sheet at a reinvestment rate to drive enough return on the capital deployed on the balance sheet? I'm happy to say that when we made the announcement, it was sort of marginal, whether we were right on the line of whether that math really worked. I'd say today it's clearly and compelling the best use of capital. Reinvestment rates are 50 basis points higher, and the quantum of cash we have is more than doubled from when we made the announcement. But importantly, and I think this speaks to the question, the costs have come down quite a bit as well.
Right.
We said when we made the announcement that it would cost $50 million of one-time implementation costs. We just recently reduced that to 20. We said that it would take $15 million of running costs. We think that's still about the right number. The cost came down because the time frame by which we have to execute delivery of all of this went out by about an additional year. We were expecting to become part of the CCAR process in 2018 under rules that were pending last year. Those rules were not published. We think now our best guess is that we will be subject to 2019's process, giving us a lot more time, and as you can imagine, you have a lot less consultants and spend and other thing you need to have in order to drive that. So, you know, where we are today with this sort of situation in Washington is that it's, you know, we're continuing to just make progress on the current plan and the law of the land as it is today, being mindful that we know that it might change. Focusing on the things that are going to add the most value, focusing on the things that we feel that we're going to be compelled to do anyway, even if the rules change. Please keep in mind that, you know, these rules, even if the bright lines shift, a lot of them can be influenced by other areas of regulation. And you could be required to do them by other existing regulation, even if the $50 billion threshold rules change. And so there probably still is likely to be some spend, even if the laws change. So the last part of your point on the tax side, I think we have to really wait to see what comes out. We've seen a lot of different proposals, a lot of different things are sort of flying around. But a lower tax rate is clearly a major positive for us. As a domestic company sourcing most of our earnings domestically, a lower tax rate will really flow right through. You know, you can add sort of 5% above the federal rate for states, and that ultimately will become the new effective tax rate.
I guess the other part of potential regulatory relief or regulatory help for you guys will be the move at the bank to get the Tier 1 leverage ratio down to 7.5%. So maybe talk us through and you know, what you're hearing from the regulators in terms of that discussion, any potential timelines we should be aware of. And then more importantly, over time, when we think about the, you know, the mix of the balance sheet and how much cleaner it is, is there a potential to run at something more like a 7% where some of your peers run?
Sure. We just wrapped up our strategic planning process and our capital plan, took it to our board of directors last week. It contemplates the levels of 7.5 at the bank. We are in active dialogue with the regulators. This is not a new surprise to them. We have been working on this, and I feel quite good that we are going to be able to achieve those in the near term, and that they won't be an impediment to our current strategy. I feel that we'll be able to deliver on them in the near term. As far as going lower, well, if the bank is at 7.5 and the parent company is at 7, we've pretty much converged in line to the industry. Now, if we look at sort of our stress testing, if we look at the fact that our portfolio, ex the legacy loan asset, will be a clean agency portfolio, we could probably mathematically support lower levels, but we don't think that we're going to be able to get there in any sort of near-term time frame. It's possible, but it's not something we think 7 and 7.5 are going to be good levels to run at for a while.
So let me open it up a little bit here to the audience. Had any questions? Is there a mic, by any chance? Hello? Do you think that there is a risk that commissions could be competed down to closer to a zero, basically trading for free on a negotiated or published rate basis over time? And if so, how might that change your strategy, if commission rates do fall out further from here?
Yeah, look, this gets back to value proposition and what you bring your customers. But there's obviously risk that commissions can continue to fall. But we think we're providing a compelling value proposition. I would also say that we've taken an approach, and our CEO likes to use the term hand-to-hand combat for the best customers. We've taken an approach of customers that bring us more value, we will pass that value back on. We think to do so is in some way unfair. So in sort of an operating of the business, we will continue to be very aggressive, for the best customers that are out there. In terms of it really going to zero, I think we have to think really hard about taking the aspect of the business which generates a significant amount of ROE and really requires the physical infrastructure of the broker-dealer plant and really cutting that quite significantly and using what's the byproduct of the business, cash, on a balance sheet, which is very capital-intensive, as a way of supporting earnings. So I think, I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but my view is that from a rational business mix, that would not be very good overall for the industry.
Any other questions? All right, maybe one more for me. You mentioned the corporate services business as an area of growth. Maybe just talk about the competitive landscape in that business. And where E-Trade fits, overall growth rates of the industry, and then I guess the best areas of potential growth for you guys.
Sure. For us, it is an area of strong competitive advantage. We service 20% of the S&P 500, about 1,000 corporate clients. We are the largest in the space, and we have the best product in the space to offer to plan sponsors in the industry. It's an industry that's quite fragmented. There's one other large player. You move below that, and it gets really quite fragmented pretty quickly in terms of the amount of assets that are out there. These are really businesses that other brokers have put on over the course of time. Technology companies are involved. So for us, there's really a twofold challenge. One, if you have the best platform, to continue to grow the number of plans, to continue the B2B effort of selling that platform and to win the marginal RFP, to showcase what that platform can do and to grow the amount of plan assets. The other challenge is really the participant side. We do pretty well today in terms of how much business this channel generates for us. We retain about 15% of proceeds after vest, about 1 year after vest. We have about 15% of the proceeds. They come through the channel, and it generates about a third of new accounts. So we're doing well from a generation standpoint, but we think we can do better. Can we engage these customers in a more meaningful way to bring wealth that's outside over to us? Can we retain more of the proceeds, and can we move up into the sort of higher wealth range that the channel provides us access into?
I guess, curious, is there anything different now relative to how you've approached that business in the past? Because, you know, it feels to me that's it's always been a source of potential growth for E-Trade, the corporate services business. So just curious what's different now.
Yeah, look, I'm well aware we've talked about the business for a long time, but there has been an evolution. The evolution started with realizing that you necessarily can't communicate to participants through email or just active sort of outreach. You have to go onto the corporate campuses. We started doing that a couple of years ago, specially trained FCs to really talk about our stock plan services and to really make them understand that they have an E-Trade account already. It's a default when they conduct a sale op on their company stock, and to really start showing them what's in that account from a products and services point of view. We're going to continue to do that. But then we also understand when we see, you know, the higher level, you know, customers in the participant chain move their assets away, that speaks to, do we need to strengthen our asset management or wealth management, I should say, capabilities in that space to really retain that customer in-house.
Maybe one last one for me, not something that seems to be a big topic anymore, but on the loan book, I guess you're now 90% through the conversions. I guess talk about what you think a more normalized kind of loan loss reserve level would look like, and then maybe looking forward, you know, remind us how you're thinking about the hold versus sell debate.
Sure. When we look at the loan book today, by the end of the quarter, the HELOC conversions, we should be down to about 5% or so left. So the event is really firmly in the rearview mirror. And I'm happy to say that performance through the event has been, you know, at or better than expectations, or I'd say at this point clearly better than expectations. And with that, the first lien conversions are progressing as well. Collateral value continues to improve. And so it's been a very good story, and thus a continuation of the release of reserves. From a charge-off perspective, we actually are in a net recovery position. We've been in a net recovery position for several quarters now. And so we're recovering off the portfolio from prior charge-offs. So overall, a very good position. You know, our position around the doing something with the portfolio is it's definitely a non-core asset, but there is just no compelling transaction that we would see as value generative. I think I would say anything that's out there would be at this point destructive to value. And there's just really, you know, while there are expenses in administering the portfolio, they're just not that large to say that you can release enough expense to make the headline of the sale worth it. So it's something that we're going to be working through for the foreseeable future.
I'll open it one more time. Question in the back.
Yeah, just curious, you know, I appreciate some of the commentary on pricing and the focus on the customer experience, but you know, I guess I'm just thinking about this. If we see someone else in the space respond, you know, do you at that point feel the need to adjust your pricing as well? I mean, really want to be an outlier to the high side here?
I would let me describe it this way. I don't want to say that last week's announcement or downplay it to the point of it wasn't from a new entrant or a startup. It wasn't from an institutional player or a large wirehouse changing to try and come into the direct space. It was from the largest player out there. So, we're going to remain vigilant. We're going to look at our customer base. We're going to listen to them carefully, look at the underlying flows and data. We're going to evaluate and carefully look at how other large players in the industry respond, and we're going to be very thoughtful about this. But we're not going to have a knee-jerk reaction to move. We don't think it's the right thing. We think that we can continue to differentiate and provide value to our customers.
Anybody else? Not? We'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you.